My name is Rick Kleffel. Welcome to the Agony Column podcast. We're speaking with Charlie Houston live in New York. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Charlie, I want to talk to you a little bit about your novel, Already Dead. It's a horror novel. Could you set this novel up for us? Tell us what the premise is and how the action starts to unfold.
The premise is pretty basic. It's contemporary New York. There are, you know, secret vampire gangs running around that people don't know about, and most of them want to stay secret. They're beating people up and killing them for their blood, and they have, you know, various wars and conflicts going on between the various gangs. And in the middle of all this, the classic noir guy is Joe Pitt, is a vampire without a gang, without a clan, and the action unfolds, is initiated by a gruesome quadruple homicide, which involves some zombies and some brain-eating and some bloodletting.
Tell us a little bit about your first two novels involved mostly straightforward mystery action.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you to write a supernatural science fictional style novel?
Fun, I think, more than anything else. I was the book, as with my first book, Caught Stealing, Already Dead was begun when I was not really seeking to make money as a writer. I had written Caught Stealing as a way to stay busy and to do something creative, and I finished it and put it aside, and I wanted to keep writing because I had wanted to write. You know, I'd always written shorter things, but I'd enjoyed writing the novel, and I wanted to try and do something else. And one of the things that had been difficult about reading Caught Stealing is, even though it's, you know, fairly high concept and it's got a lot of action and everything, I still wanted it to have a certain amount of verisimilitude. And, you know, without any real knowledge of police procedure and, you know, what it feels like to get shot and stuff, that was fairly difficult. And one of the things that I knew would make it easier was to have vampires. Right there, the rules just go out the window. So it was kind of a way to entertain myself. And so I had written a chunk of it, and then I got sidetracked by some other things that I was working on, and time passed, and in the interim, I sold Caught Stealing and a sequel. And at some point, I had very quickly had run out of advance money and was, you know, hoping to get to work on another book as quickly as possible. And my agent told me that it was going to be difficult to sell another mystery at that moment to my publisher, but that if I wanted to try and write something in another genre, that he might be able to work something out. And he said, so, you know, I don't know, if you had something horror project or something you wanted to work on, and there I was with 100 pages of a vampire book sitting in a drawer, lucky me, it turned out that it was something that people were interested in, and once again, lucky me, I got to finish the book.
One of the things that you have a lot of fun with, and you do really well in this novel, is you find humor in violence. You find humor in violence all the time. How do you do that?
Oh, Christ, I don't know. I think part of it is, my experience of life is that, you know, absurd things don't stop happening just because there's a tragedy or just because there's, you know, a disaster or because somebody is being hurt. And so there's that. I think it also may just be symptomatic of my ignorance of physical violence. You know, it's been many years since the last time I threw a punch, and I've never been shot at. I've never shot at anybody, any of that stuff. In trying to give the violence some kind of authenticity, you know, that my description of the havoc it wreaks can only go so far. And there's something, to me, there's something about the idea of somebody slipping on a banana peel, as they're staggering around with a bullet in their gut, that is not only funny, but also, to me, feels really honest and really true. Like I said, I don't think the world suddenly, you know, the world doesn't stop when horrible things happen, and part of the world is funny, stupid shit happening constantly. I don't know how much sense that makes, but that's the best I can do there.
You seem to like to take your sympathetic characters, your main characters, and drive them to committing unimaginable violence. They become as bad or worse than the bad guys. Why do you do that?
Well, with Joe Pitt, with the protagonist in Already Dead, it's kind of a part of it is, you know, it's a given. That's the kind of character. I don't think there's a in him that it's necessary that he's driven to do these horrible things. These horrible things are already in him, and as I conceive that character, he's already done before that book. The first page of that book, he's done much worse previously in his life than anything that he's going to do in that book. I hate pussy vampires. Joe's got a certain amount of, you know, of Bezos in there, but I hate the mopey, I can't kill people vampire, you know, it's bad thing. I wanted to write about a vampire who's a badass. So for him, it's just part of his nature. With Henry, with the protagonist in Caught Stealing and Six Bad Things, it wasn't something that I started out planning to do. I didn't really know where that first book, where Caught Stealing, was going to go. But at a certain point when I was writing it, I realized that there was an arc that was developing that had to do with this change that he was going through from a very regular guy who was, you know, was absolutely a lover, not a fighter, into somebody that whom circumstances was making capable of these acts of violence. And once I recognized that it was happening, it was natural to, you know, emphasize it and make it to a certain extent the point of the book. I know it's different for every writer. For me, I wasn't necessarily that aware of why that was happening or how it was happening. In retrospect, I look back at it and I think there's some of my feelings about violence and what it does to people and how experiencing violence, or whether you're committing the acts of violence or whether, you know, they're happening to you, transforms people, and more to the point, killing, whether you're a witness to it or whether you're doing it. I don't think that anybody that is remotely mentally stable goes through that experience without being profoundly changed. And another thing that I hate, not only do I hate mopey pussy vampires, but I hate stories in which characters, particularly a protagonist and someone who otherwise is not inclined to violence, they commit acts of violence and there's no change in the character. Or worse, there's no change in the character before they commit the act of violence. You don't see that growing. So I did that in the first book, almost incidentally, and then recognized it, you know, after the fact. And when I got the opportunity to write a sequel, I remember what I told the editor who was interested in the sequel. I said, well, look, I do have an idea for a sequel, but it's really the middle book of a trilogy, and the whole arc of the trilogy would be how Henry goes from a normal guy to how he becomes not just a guy capable of violence, but a guy who is committing acts of violence as a profession, and descends, you know, completely how his life is overwhelmed by the violence around him, and he becomes a violent person, and then with a finale that revolves around whether or not he can redeem himself, whether or not there will be redemption. And that's the third book is about, and the final book in that trilogy is about, can you come back from that? You know, you can't be a regular guy ever again, but is there anything you can do to make up for what you've done?
One of the strengths of your books is the dialogue. I'm wondering, how do you write it? Do you just write it down? Do you speak it? Do you rehearse it?
I don't speak it. I don't rehearse it. Some of the dialogue, some of it spins out of control. You know, some of it is, you know, there are definitely those times where, the cliche that writers talk about, I'm just listening to the characters and they're telling me what the story is and stuff. And once again, every writer has a different experience, you know, and different process. For me, I find that is the case sometimes, and particularly with dialogue. There will be moments in the action that suggest a line, and then things just roll from there. There are other times when I'll hear a line, hear somebody in real life say something that I think is interesting. We were watching something in the Olympics, and somebody was either skating or snowboarding or doing something, and they had their background music was Bruce Springsteen. We were talking about that as a choice, and one of my buddies said, man, if you can't win to Springsteen, you can't win to nothing. And I had to write it down. I know that at some point I'm going to have some jamoke you know, talking about sports or something like that, and there'll be that line. So some of these things just come from real life, and then once I have that line, sometimes I'll look for a character that might be able to speak it. Sometimes I'll, you know, I've had a couple characters that I've created based on a bit of dialogue that I thought was really strong, and then from writing out the dialogue, this is suggests the character, and the character has developed.
One of the things you do well with language is you show a great facility at creatively and humorously using the word fuck. So tell me about this, because it's a really interesting stylistic choice, and I think you do it really well.
You know, I wish it was a choice. I wish I could say it. But in the same way that I'm not entirely certain that a person can be taught how to write, I'm not entirely certain that a person can be taught how to use the word fuck naturally. And, you know, you got to learn it somewhere, but certain, some things are just innate. I come from a family that is, you know, vulgar. Everybody from my grandparents on down on both sides of my family, we've always just, you know, there's just always been a lot of raw language. I just grew up with it, and that word just rolls off my lips as automatically as anything. There's just nothing conscious. It's just such a, it's just such an automatic word. I think it was, I can't remember if it was Six Bad Things or Already Dead, but when I went to my editor for the first pass, I came back, and, you know, he's already read one or two of my books, and we spent a lot of time together, so he knows how I talk and all that. And he says, now look, I know this book ain't going to be G-rated, but I did draw a line through a few fucks on this one. He said, I think you may have had a heavy hand. So I was like, oh, fuck you, dude. I mean, come on, this is what I do. And I actually went through and reading that particular manuscript, whichever one it was, I did realize that it was a little fuck heavy, and some selective editing. And I actually ended up cutting a few that he didn't. And I just finished a first draft of a standalone that I'm working on that's about teenagers. And, you know, teenagers just curse worse than anybody else. Or certainly I did when I was a kid, and most of the teenagers I hear when I overhear them talking. I went through to do my own line editing before I submitted it, and I don't think that there was a page in that book that didn't have at least one fuck in it, man. So I had to do a certain amount of pruning, but I, you know, I'm just foul-mouthed.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the plotting of this novel. Especially
okay.
In terms of...
There's a plot?
there is one. I detected it underneath all the bloodshed, the violence, and the constant use of the word fuck.
It's translucent, but it's in there.
It's in there.
Crap, I put a plot in?
Okay, well, vampire noir.
Sure.
It's been done before, but I think that you do a superb job on it. So tell me a little bit, had you looked at some of the other vampire noirs?
No, I'm not really well read in the genres that I write in. You know, I've particularly horror. I've read very little horror in the course of, there was a big, you know, glut of Stephen King when I was a teenager, and I've read a little bit of Clive Barker and a lot of Lovecraft when I was a kid, and, you know, Dracula, and, you know, I just a dot here and a dot there. Other than that, you know, I'm a big horror movie fan, so I've absorbed a lot of the horror tradition, you know, that in terms of how I think about horror comes from the movies and less from books. So I know that there are vampire noirs out there, but I haven't really read any of them, although to a certain extent, I mean, Dracula is by definition gothic, but I think it has a lot of noir qualities to it. Although I never really thought about that until somebody asked me a question about it recently. And once again, it was another one of those things that wasn't to get really hardcore noir like it ended up being was not my initial instinct. You know, originally I was definitely going to have, you know, the PI fixer character who is a vampire, and then the story kind of built around that with the different clans. And originally I was just going to have one big clan that controlled the whole island of Manhattan, and then it became more interesting to break it up into all these other distinct groups. And as the plot such as it is started to develop, I realized that, you know, that I was getting really hard-boiled, and there would be times where I'd have Joe saying things that were, you know, really smart-alecky and, you know, doing that whole talking out of his side of the mouth and smoking a cigarette and drinking whiskey thing. There was a point where I just realized that it just needed to be pushed over the edge. And if I was going to do it, I needed to really do it. And I picked up a couple of my old Chandler books and a couple of my old Hammetts, and I read them actually while I was working on the book to really get that sensibility kind of in the back of my head. Whereas with the Henry books, I really avoid reading mysteries or thrillers while I'm working on those so that I can try and be clean of the influence of other writers while I'm actively working on the book. But with Joe, I tried very aggressively to get that old school noir into the book and to really go for it. So, you know, it's not a terribly original idea, but there's a reason for that. It's because it, you know, it comes very naturally. It's, you know, it's very suited. You know, the horror and noir, there's a certain amount of overlap there. I usually compare, I think, in tone and Joe's voice and the already dead Ace Chandler, but in terms of the plotting and the way it's resolved at the end, I think it's I'm more copying Hammett's moves with, you know, there's a lot of exposition at the end, which I try to frame in a way that's entertaining so that the reader isn't falling asleep there. But that whole, you know, thing of characters explaining all of these crazy plot twists and stuff is a very Hammett thing to do. And that was the other thing. There was the plot twists were really building and building, and I was like, I knew that I needed to either lean it out or I needed to go for it. And you know, going for it just seemed like a much more entertaining option. So that was part of how that happened.
Your vampires are science fiction based rather than supernatural based.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Thanks for saying science fiction, because they're definitely not science-based. Their vampirism is supposedly the result of a virus. But anyone that knows anything about what viruses are and how they work and all of that will immediately, you know, any of the pseudoscience that comes up in the book, they'll immediately start punching holes in this. I have a friend who's a biochemist, and he gave me some cool ideas to play with, but I, you know, was horrified when he actually read the manuscript, because I knew that he was just going to, you know, he was going to hate what I, and he didn't give a shit about any of that stuff, obviously. I wanted it to be over the top. I wanted it to be fun. I wanted it to be wild and it to be a world that allowed me to go further than I can go with the straight thrillers. But I also wanted, and here's that word again, I wanted a certain amount of verisimilitude. I wanted it to be a recognizable world. And I also wanted to have, to make it, for, I really wanted to have this whole aspect where Joe makes fun of the traditional vampire myths and makes fun of people who are into them. However, as the books go on, and there definitely is a second book, and I'm hoping that'll in the end it'll be a series of five or six books, the idea that I have is that while each book will have a standalone story, that there will be an arc that goes through the entire series that is the mystery of just exactly what is this virus that makes them vampires. And is it actually, you know, just a virus, or is there a supernatural aspect to it? And that's going to kind of be a thing that I play with, and I already know what the answer is. The question will be whether or not somebody buys the books and I get to resolve it.
Tell us a little bit about retooling the Mafia for Undeath.
Well, the Mafia wasn't exactly what I had in mind. I called them gangs earlier, but in the book they're referred to as clans. So there's these collections of clans that run the vampire underworld. And my initial idea, as I said, was that there was going to be one big clan that ran everything and that Joe was outside of. And I called it the Coalition, which I actually chose that name. This was 2000 when I was first writing this, so this was well before there was before the Coalition was a popular reference to any kind of, that had any kind of political weight to it. But my idea was more of this kind of monolithic bureaucracy as opposed to a mafia. And I just, you know, I liked the idea that there were people running things and, you know, as a counterpoint, as opposed to just a bunch of vampires running around. And this, you know, also suited the whole, you know, if your hard guy is going to be an outsider, he needs to have something to be outside of. And then, like I said, it became more interesting to have people working in opposition to this coalition. And the first group that occurred to me was the Society, which, you know, is this clan of politically correct hippies and anarchists and feminists and operating out of the East Village who happen to be vampires. So just trying to create those natural oppositions. I actually do have a small clan in the back of my head based in Little Italy that I haven't gotten to use yet, that I'm hoping, if I get to do a third book, that I hope to introduce, that will actually be, you know, specifically mafia-based thing.
Your novels feature a lot of torture, which is in the news of late, and I'm wondering, is it just because you like to write about torture, or are you getting just verging into the political?
I don't think the political is there very consciously in any of the books to date. There are political references in the second Joe Pitt book, which I have written, that are conscious and are overt. I have a reference to a vampire settlement being somebody referring to it as the vampire version of the Gaza Strip, and I have a vampire talking about a character being taken from one place to the other and referring to that process as rendition. The rendition was the, and it's not, I'm not necessarily trying to, with those specific references in this book that is yet to be published, it's not necessarily to say something, but this is part of the dialogue in our world today. I like the idea that these things would be reference points within the vampire world as well, that they would be aware of current events beyond their own lives and reference them. And that was more how I wanted to use them. With rendition, it was specifically the first time I heard the phrase extreme rendition, it just stuck in my head because it was just a real powerful combination of words. And then, you know, when I looked up the dictionary definition of rendition and saw some of the sub-definitions and whatnot, I just thought it was a very potent word, and it just applied very well to the situation I was writing about in the book, so I wanted to use it. Likewise with the Gaza Strip reference. It was very easy to apply it to the situation I was writing about in the book. The general use of torture in the books, once again, it has something to do with the way I deal with violence and think about violence. It started in Caught Stealing. The first time was there's a really over the top brutal torture scene in that book where the protagonist has surgical staples ripped out. And it wasn't planned. It was one of those things where I hadn't had him, the character, to have surgery intending to have him be tortured later. I got to the scene where I wanted something just horrific. You know, I wanted something completely horrific that would drive a character completely just bonkers and, you know, out into the street and just something really awful. And then I was like, oh yeah, he just had surgery. I could do this. And then it just, once I started actually thinking about what that experience might be like, then, you know, the scene got longer and more detailed and more awful, and there were more fluids and, you know, more screaming and, you know, and stuff like that. And just pretty much the same with all of that stuff. I don't, even though I drop the humor in to these scenes, I don't want them to be, I want, part of the reason that they're so graphic, part of the reason that I deal with the violence like that is because I want there to be something about it that's horrific. And I think, going back to what you're asking about the humor, that may be an aspect of it as well, that the humor provides a little bit of contrast to that and heightens it to a certain extent. And like I say, I'm not saying that I do that consciously, but it's very important to me that the violence be something that's flinch-worthy. I know for some people have told me that it's just entertaining, that they just, you know, they just get their socks knocked off by it. And you know, you don't always produce the effect in everybody. There are always going to be people where you're, you know, what you're writing suggests something other than what you're hoping for. But that's kind of what I'm gunning for, particularly with those scenes of really horrific graphic violence. I'm hoping that, you know, people need to blink, you know, or have some kind of reaction to it. Or when people tell me that they read the torture scene in Caught Stealing, that they have to put the book down for a minute, I'm not, you know, pumping my fist in the air. Yeah, gotcha. But I feel like that's, you know, I hope that some people have that reaction to it.
And finally, I want to ask you, Caught Stealing was originally issued as a hardcover.
Yes.
The follow-up, Six Bad Things, came out as a trade paperback and was nominated for an Edgar Award for Best Original Paperback Mystery.
Well, why, thank you for mentioning that.
And Already Dead was also issued as a trade paperback.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is there a marketing strategy in terms of issuing these as trade paperbacks in that it makes them as eligible for awards that they might otherwise not be eligible for? Do you know that?
I can answer this question. Let me do Already Dead for, because that's the easiest, shortest answer. Already Dead was just simply sold that way. That was, you know, that was when the contract that I signed was for a trade paperback contract. So those books were always intended to come out as trade paperbacks. And part of that is just that, you know, unless your name is Stephen King, you know, you don't, hardcover horror just really doesn't get done. Stephen King, Clive Barker, I'm sure there are a couple other guys out there. It's hardcore genre fiction, and that stuff is read in paperback. That's, you know, the buyer is a paperback buyer. You know, they tend to read a lot of the stuff. They buy a lot of books. They buy a lower price point, and that's for the reader. And also because these books are very specifically, they're set in the East Village, in the bar scene and whatnot, and the thought was that these books will appeal to a younger, more cash-conscious reader as well. So those books were always going to be trade paper. With the thrillers, initially, Caught Stealing and Six Bad Things were both meant to come out in hardback, and what happened there was initially, it was just an issue of commerce. Caught Stealing had a very strong initial print run in hardback, but did not sell. So when Six Bad Things was, and this is all very businessy and probably tedious for a lot of people, but when Six Bad Things was taken out to the booksellers and they were asked to place their orders, they were reluctant to carry that many of them because they had ordered so many Caught Stealings and it had not sold. At that point, it was really a matter of my publisher sitting down and saying, well, do we push Six Bad Things as a hardback and hope for the best, or do we maybe reconsider our strategy because trade paperback does sell to a different audience than hardback does? I thought that it was the right choice to make. I was a little disappointed that it was a choice that was made at the last minute, but it seems to have paid off. The initial print run for Six Bad Things was considerably smaller than the run for Caught Stealing. However, it's now had three printings. It was nominated for the Edgar, and if it had come out in hardback, in which case it would have been eligible for Edgar for the best book of the year, the truth is the competition would have been much stiffer. The standards are different, and it probably wouldn't have gotten that nomination. I don't think awards were a consideration when they made the choice, but it certainly seems to have helped. And I think that my work is probably, at least these books are probably better suited to a trade paperback audience, to a reader that, according to the demographics, tends to be a little younger, tends to have a little less pocket money, tends to be a little more adventurous about what they're willing to buy. And it also means that for folks out there who are really set in their ways and maybe have a little more money, they're more inclined to take a chance on a book that costs 12, 13 bucks as opposed to a book that costs 21 to 25 bucks. So the short answer to this is pure commerce. This was ultimately a money decision, but it really seems to be working out. And Caught Stealing has sold much better in trade paperback than it did in hardback. So it seems to be something that's working out. And it was rough the way it actually went down, but over the long run, I've been very pleased with the decision.
We've been speaking with Charlie Houston. He's the author of Caught Stealing, Six Bad Things, and Already Dead. Thanks for speaking with us, Charlie.
You bet, man. Glad to do so.
All right, thanks.